There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
A hearty welcome to you to the Nerdist Podcast. A couple of quick announcements. September 24th, the Nerdist TV special on BBC America at 10/9 Central. After a little show called Doctor Who. And then guess what? The Doctor himself, Matt Smith, will be on the show along with a genius guest, Craig Ferguson. So they'll be there. Please watch the show. And I will hug you if I ever see you in person, if you do. Also, October 14th, we're going to be doing two shows at the Gramercy Theater in New York City. That's a 7:30 and a 10:30 show. I think the 10:30 may be sold out. There's probably some few tickets left for the 7:30. October 22nd, we'll be at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. November 6th, we'll be at the 9:30 Club in D.C. And then November 8th, at the Iron Horse Music Hall in Northampton, Massachusetts. So information for all that stuff is at Nerdist.com. And that's all the announcements right now. So please enjoy the Nerdist Podcast with Mr. Tom Green. Also, just a quick note, more hostful episodes coming soon. Matt, Joan, and I have all been crazy busy working on our respective jobs and have had much difficulty all getting into a room at the same time. So we will come back with more of those soon. So thanks for sticking with us after a couple week break from those. All right, I'm going to shut now. Okay, shutting up. Okay, all right.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
In 1996, right?
2006?
2006. Well, this would have been cutting edge in 1996, yes, recording onto CDs.
We have to output onto compact discs. And then take those and burn them onto a...
All right. Yeah, that should be really? Your mic's right there. You can put the headphones on. We're already recording the show.
All right.
That's it.
We've started. We've officially started.
All right. I like officially starting stuff.
Let's move that microphone closer to your... There we go. Perfect.
Okay. Is that part on the air?
Yeah, that was all in the air.
Okay. So then it really did officially start when you said it.
I really did.
That's cool.
There's no real official start to the show.
Oh, really?
It's a quasi-professional operation, Tom.
You just said we officially started.
I guess I did.
Is that not really the official start?
I just negated my own thesis statement.
There's no fanfare, though. We just kind of stumble into recording.
No.
have fanfare.
You ever mix anything in after?
Like
some applause or anything? Or some music? Maybe a little music?
Jonah so bad wants a sound effects board to turn this into a morning zoo show.
I would love to. I love it. Yeah. I would like something like this where it's just farts and awesome power sound.
And other farts.
You can do that. What about an opening theme song, though? You think maybe that might help?
We have.
I mean, I'm not saying you guys need help. You're here in the middle of Beverly Hills in this amazing studio. Clearly, you're doing something right.
We sold.
You know,
our
when
souls.
I hear podcast, I think sitting in a bus shelter somewhere talking into a cell phone or something.
Humble
like
beginnings.
That.
Yep.
Yeah,
no, those are the old days. Last year.
Like last year.
Oh, now it's
you're
all
in
now
your
it's
own
all snazzy.
Studio, Ryan Seacrest's studio.
That's right. He doesn't know we're here.
Yeah, you just barge in here.
We sneak in.
It's good.
Under the radar.
Professional microphones.
Yep.
A professional audio engineer.
Yep. He doesn't actually work for us.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Nick, get back to work.
Yeah.
He didn't even listen.
It's cool. So when people download the show.
Yes, sir.
Well, like, how's that work? Where are they going to find it? How are they going to find it?
Well, we have an audience of people who already listen to the show.
Yeah.
And then they either get it on the internet through the RSS feed, or they get it through iTunes or through any other number of delivery systems, and that's how they get it. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
I am excited to talk to all of them.
Now, Tom.
How are you guys doing? Everybody okay. listening. How are you guys doing?
We're okay, Tom.
Oh, good, good. It's great to be here.
I'm doing so good.
But you when you started, did you start on a public access channel in Canada?
I did, yeah.
You were sort of doing a version of podcasting early on.
Yeah, I'm kind of kidding around with you guys. I've been involved in this sort of, you know I'm kidding around.
No.
Obviously I'm kidding
around. We get irony.
Yeah, obviously we're just joking around here
We're having fun.
We haven't even really started.
Not at all.
Any sort of an interview yet.
Nope.
I don't think you guys have even introduced me, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm. Tom Green is here.
Yeah, exactly. People might, for all anybody knows, they're listening to someone else, you know?
Yep.
But when I said, how do they find it, I thought maybe like, it said, you know, podcast with me or something. So they
it
would
will
know.
Say, it will say. It will say.
They read it. They read it.
They read it if they... Yeah. If
do
they,
people read?
They might have read it off read? Of their do screens.
Does anyone read?
It's like listening with your eyes. Yeah. It's like listening with your eyes.
They could read it on the screen.
They could read it on the screen.
They could see that it was me, even though I haven't really yet been officially introduced.
It could be a weird psychic link.
Yeah.
That they just automatically, like, I feel the presence of Tom Green somewhere near a mobile device.
And then you guys could introduce me now, but then a lot of people listening might not even know who I am, you know?
I would venture to guess that everyone listening knows who you are.
Everyone? You think every single person?
If people know who I am, I guarantee you they know who you are.
Well, I don't even have to be here then.
No, you automatically promote yourself just by being Tom Green.
I'm doing a show in Boston.
You're doing it at the Wilbur.
At the Wilbur.
Which is an awesome theater.
September 30th. This is a very exciting show for me because we're doing my first television special, a stand-up television special, filming it, and I've been touring doing stand-up for the last I've been on the road for like 2 years now, pretty much nonstop. I've traveled all over the world. I was just in Australia. Mm-hmm. I was in Afghanistan. I was in Scotland. I was in London. I was all over Canada, everywhere in the U.S., and my shows are selling out everywhere. We're having huge laughs. People are going crazy. It's pandemonium. Massive, massive, massive laughs, constant, insane laughs.
Wait, how insane?
It's insanity,
like,
man.
Maniacal laughter?
Honestly, that's the most exciting thing that I've ever done in my life right now, doing stand-up comedy. I've wanted to do it. I did it when I was a teenager. Then I started my show on public access, and I did my show for many years, and it was on MTV, and I was always sort of secretly thinking, you know, I really would like to be on the road full time doing stand up and getting up in front of people in as opposed to just talking to a television camera, which can be a very isolating experience, you know, and it's a very bureaucratic experience putting a television show together, whereas just getting out independent, getting up in front of crowds, it's been fun. So it's a very exciting time for me right now. I'm very excited about this stand-up comedy special I'm shooting. And that's actually why I'm really happy that you guys asked me to come on the show, because I know you have millions of listeners, and anybody who's anywhere near Boston, please get in your car and get to Boston on September 30th. Do me a favor, go on your Twitter or your Facebook page right now, if you're listening, and tweet this for me, or Facebook, put it on your wall, say, hey, let's go to Boston September 30th,
mm-hmm.
and tell them what it is, my show, Tom Green at the Wilbur Theater.
Which again is a phenomenal theater. Yeah, I performed there earlier in the year. It's amazing.
Yeah, isn't it a great spot? Yeah,
it's gorgeous. It's a beautifully restored old theater. It's in a great part of town. The people were really nice. You're gonna love the Wilbur Theater. It's really fantastic.
Yeah, it's exciting. You know, I just was at the Edinburgh Comedy Festival.
I read all the reviews, and they were all overwhelmingly positive.
Yeah, it was really exciting.
Which is tough. Which is a tough thing, I think, to get for Edinburgh.
Yeah.
There are thousands of shows.
Yeah, and they're very, very, they take their stand-up very seriously.
Did you do the whole month, or did you do a shorter run?
I did 2 weeks. I did 12 shows nightly, every night at 11 till midnight, and I had a great time, it was just awesome. It was awesome. You know, like I said, I've been kind of really have been performing and writing jokes in this show with the idea of putting it together for a special in mind. Mm-hmm. So it's something that I'm not really just getting up every night and just sort of winging it, obviously. Mm-hmm. I have a very sort of structured thing that I'm working on and writing new things for and adding and subtracting from really on a daily basis for the last couple of years. And I'm actually really looking forward to doing this special because then I can start over and write some start, you know, like I mean, Every week I get up on stage, I'm doing a lot of new material, and it's different, but I want to start in just sort of a new theme and start from scratch.
Go ahead, John Ray.
Is that something you're going to continue to do, you think, like each year, a new hour?
Yeah, I think so, absolutely. Maybe not each year, maybe something like that. But yeah.
A new hour every year is tough. Louis C.K. can do it because he's a wizard of some sort.
I don't really look at it so much like that. Like I'm starting to improvise a lot more in my show, and you know, now than I was when I first jumped on stage, when I was really just writing material and ideas. And
how do you write versus, I mean, for your show, which was really, you know, a lot of like social experiment, where you sort of go out and fuck with people. How much of that? I mean, obviously there's a certain improv element to it, because you don't know how people are going to react, but
I've always felt very strongly, even on my television show. In fact, probably why I started my television show, that, you know, there was a, you know, the point of the show was to try to smash the conventions of traditional TV and the way we perceive that television is made. And by doing things like putting poo in a microphone, sticking them under someone's nose and noticing that nobody, that the person, you know, becomes mesmerized by the camera and doesn't notice that there's a piece of dog poo in their face. You know, of course, it's funny on a very silly and childish level, which is why we all laugh when we see it. But it's also making a point, which is we're all nuts, you know, and then TV is very, very, you know. So with I've always had this sort of desire to kind of take on the status quo and poke fun at the world in that way. And stand-up has been, honestly, probably the place where I'm able to do it more than anywhere else, because you're on stage, you have a whole hour to talk, and you can really get into a little bit more detail, as opposed to on television where you're dealing with 3-minute clips and you're sort of really just, you're running everything through this corporate structure, and you've got editors and writers, and you never really get to know a person and what the way they feel about something as a performer. And so, you know, I'm talking about all sorts of different things that I'm very I guess to answer your question, how do I write? I start by things that I'm passionate about, that I feel are ridiculous, that I feel are wrong with the world, you know. And when something like that pops into my head, I'll make a note of it. I'll remember that. I'll think about it for a few days. Maybe the joke itself pops into my head right away. I'm always making lists of things. I really am very sort of mechanical about it, to be honest with you. I write it down in my phone. I've got, you know, notes, and then I usually sit down and write it up, you know, pretty much word for word, what I think would be the funniest way of approaching it in the cadence of stand-up, and then I get up and I try it, and then I massage it and work it out on the road for a period of time. I think it's nothing really sort of abnormal about the way I write, really.
Right.
But I love it. I love doing it. And I love, you know, I'm talking a lot in my show about our addiction to technology and Facebook addictions, and people can't get off their cell phones and things that are going on, you know, with the, you know, I talk about politics. I talk about things in the media. I talk about lots of sort of different types of subjects. I talk about things that I've gone through in my personal life. But, you know, I'm having a lot of fun with it. It's a very silly, ridiculous show. I'm running around. I run around a lot. There's a lot of, it's loud at times. I like to get into people's face in the audience. I'm really trying not to be sort of, ashamed of being silly. Because I don't want to be sitting there preaching away to a crowd about how they're addicted to their cell phone for an hour like I'm some sort of authority on it. I really want people laughing and having a good time. So,
do you prefer? Some people feel differently about this on either side of the topic, but do you find it more challenging or fun to perform for people who already know who you are, and so they're already kind of on your side, or do you sort of like the challenge of, because I'm sure in Edinburgh you had a bit of people coming to shows and they maybe weren't familiar with you and you had to kind of win them over a little bit. Do you like that challenge?
You know, I do. I mean, to be honest with you, in Edinburgh it was just like everywhere else it's been. You know, the funny thing about YouTube and the internet, which is amazing, is it's reinvigorated life into every single comedy bit that I've ever shot in the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. From me painting my parents' house plaid to, you know, the slutmobile
to
stuff that I've been doing recently on my website, like rapping with Exhibit or Flavor Flav or you know, everything I've done has sort of all become new again in a way. And so when I'm in Scotland, or whether I'm in Scotland or Toronto or Chicago or Sydney, Australia, the audience pretty much knows this huge breadth of bits that I've done. Sometimes I'll shout. So to be honest with you, that can be a distraction to me sometimes when people are I've developed a way of incorporating it all into my show so that the energy from the crowd really, really pushes me and pushes the show into a crazy place.
That's the kind of shit that drives Chappelle crazy sometimes when people are like, they yell Rick James at him. He's like, can I just do my jokes, please?
So I found a way to kind of actually control the audience to a certain extent, you know. I mean, I don't want to get into it too much detail because I don't want people to know how I do it.
Sure.
You know, because then it'll change the show.
Of course.
You know, people know where I'm coming from.
We don't want the virus to mutate.
But there's certain ways you can kind of speak to a crowd and control a crowd and keep heckling to a certain level.
Yeah.
And I apply these things that I've kind of figured out over the last 2 years. It's a good question because it's a very specific thing that deals with me. You know, that applies to my show is that I do have, you know, if I'm playing at in Boston or Chicago or you know, half the audience is there because they are here to see a comedy show, the other half of the audience is there because they're big fans of the MTV show or Freddie Got Fingered, you know, which is a completely different type of person. Half my audience sometimes maybe has never even been to a stand-up show before, you know, and they're screaming out, "Daddy, would you like some sausage?" and things like this. But at the end of the day, they're so passionate and excited to be there that the energy in the room is this big sort of thing, which I, you know, play into, and that's why my show's a very high energy show. I wouldn't be able to go out, I don't think, and just stand there and just sort of tell jokes in one spot for an hour because I think there's so much energy in the room that I have to keep it kind of big.
Do you feel that you have to somehow teach the audience that's never been to a show before, like how to act during it? Like, like you were saying, you settle them down, but is it normally just the old Tom Green Show fans?
Well, not, you know, the thing is, it's good is I've gotten a good rhythm with it now where at the end of the day, the people that watched my old show on MTV, you know, that was still had a comedy rhythm to it. You know, it was television, but it was still set up, laugh, set up, laugh, set up, laugh. And I think people are expecting something along that lines. I think what's cool about the people that have never seen my stand-up before, they aren't really sure what it's going to be. Whether they're big fans of my old stuff or just big fans of stand-up, you know, they don't know what it's going to be. And so I'm able to kind of use that to my advantage right now, you know, which is cool. I'm excited about the special coming out because then people will know what it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as I continue doing stand-up into the future, it will probably be even scarier
in a way though. Is it scarier because when you're putting your stand up out there, your show was definitely you, but it was kind of one facet of you. But since your stand up is so many different elements of who you are, really who you are and what you genuinely care about, is there any sort of like, I hope people are cool with this? Or are you more minded of like, listen, I push it out there, people like it or they don't like it, and that's out of my control?
I've sort of got a slightly different perspective on what I want to do with stand-up than I maybe have had in the past even. You know, a lot of times in the past, especially when I was a bit younger, you know, the goal was to really piss off the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of comedians do this.
Definitely young comedians. Yeah. They love that.
And I think sometimes when you're young, you do that out of a element of fear.
Yes.
Which is, well, just in case they don't get me, well, I'm going to really piss them off, and then half the people will love it because half the people are pissed off, and it's a fun technique, and I love doing it.
And it also allows you to control the outcome because this is going
to
piss people off, so I control
that. Everyone off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, you know, I've gotten really good at identifying when I'm going down that road. That's not to say that I'm not doing it all the time, but it's a certain amount of the pacing of a show. I will do things that will really play with an audience's feelings. I will say something that might be upsetting to a certain amount of people, but then I'll, you know, go to another joke that would sort of whiplash them right back into sort of a different place. So I think sometimes certainly more conservative people in the audience are sort of trying to figure out exactly who I am and what I stand for throughout the show. And at the same time, they're also agreeing with me. So It's a fun thing, and I think, you know, it's taken me probably a lot of years to figure out that, you know, it's not always, you know, to just figure out that rhythm, you know, so that it's just not constantly battering people over the head with stuff that is just so outrageously offensive that you lose the audience as a whole. And doing stand-up has been great, you know, because you have, you know, a focus group in front of you every night of 500 people, 1,000 people. They're sitting there. You know, are they... I can feel the energy of an audience.
Absolutely.
Half the crowd is sort of like, ooh, wait a minute, I don't know about how I feel about that. And the other half is like, yeah, you know, can I swear on here?
Yes.
You know, yeah, fuck that. That's right on, you know? So it's like, you know, I've kind of shaped the show in a way where when I get that feeling that I've got some polarizing jokes, I don't do too many of those in a row, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I go to one that's like, if I do a joke, some jokes that are really polarizing and offending the more conservative people, then I might follow it up with something that they're going to really respond to. And then it's sort of a little bit of a roller coaster ride for everybody.
That's really, I mean, what happened with you and the MTV show, please forgive me for not knowing this, was your show, I imagine your show must have been pretty big in Canada before it came to the States, or was it sort of a gem that MTV plucked out? I'm not even sure. What was that?
It was essentially an underground sort of cult show in Canada. It was beginning to pop up there. I did it for about 5 years on a public access TV station in Ottawa, Canada, which is, you know, not exactly show business central for Canada. That's Toronto or Vancouver, but it's, you know, or Montreal. But I was in Ottawa. And the show sort of plugged along. Me and some friends of mine made this show, and just voluntarily, and it sort of grew and became this big thing in Ottawa, relatively big amongst young people. Sure. Who were into, you know, college radio and stuff like that. And, you know, it was just starting to kind of break in Canada. We got picked up by the Comedy Network in Canada in the first season of the Comedy Network, and we did 2 years of that show. And I was just starting to go on some of the more national television shows in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And was actively trying to get some sort of, you know, job out of it. You know, I've been volunteering doing it for 5 years. So I was sending my tapes to everybody and MTV included. And they responded to it, saw, you know, I had about 700 comedy bits on video that were ready to air, and that stuff started circulating around MTV, and they picked it up. So it was sort of like, you know, one of those sort of really kind of, it was like a punk band getting a record deal. You know,
it was amazing,
a real interesting story. You know, that was really a life changing thing. You know, but I wrote, you know, I've written about this on my website. I've talked about this. You know, is, you know, it was you know, if you you know, we really did focus on this thing for, you know, almost 10 years, you know, before it had any real success, you know. So it was pretty exciting. MTV hooked me up in a big way, you know, because it changed everything at that point.
The 10-year overnight success story.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's kind of why in America, unless people are paying attention or people that are actually really fans of mine, but outside of that, if people who weren't really paying attention to exactly how it all went down, I don't think really understood where I came from. This show came on MTV and it was just so outrageous. And, you know, because we basically repackaged 7 years of shows and took all our favorite stuff and put it into 10 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of hammered people, you know, over the head, because it was just sort of, you know, it was just shockingly funny.
I was working at MTV at the same time as you.
Completely ridiculous.
I was working there at the same time that show came on. And I remember, I mean, it almost instantly you became a part of American pop culture, like a really big part of American pop culture.
Yeah.
And you know, like when people start sort of referring to you the way that they do, you know, it's like, oh, that's a Tom Green thing. Like if someone fucks with someone in public, like you sort of became like an adjective in a way, like pretty quickly. Did you have any sense of that, or did it feel like, yes, finally, or were you sort of like exhausted at the end of the finish line? Like, oh God, I'm so finally.
No, it was the most exciting thing to have happened at that point in my life. You know, it was amazing. You know, it was a dream come true, you know, and, you know, all of a sudden you're on Letterman and you're Oprah's bringing you and your parents on and flying your parents off to Tahiti and all the, and you're like, what's going on?
Do you feel more pressure at that point? Because
yeah,
before,
you feel a lot more pressure.
Because before, I feel like this is kind of what was happening with Chappelle's show too. When he would, I brought him up twice already. This show, I don't know why, because he's amazing. But his for the first season of his show, it's like, oh, we're flying under the radar. We can do whatever we want. And then all of a sudden, super famous. And then there's a lot of, it's like, oh, okay, what are you going to do now, funny guy?
Where's the catchphrases now?
Yeah. So how do you sort of wrap your mind around that?
It's a whole process, and it takes years to figure it out, really. And you don't have years. You know, it's happening instantly every day. So, you know, it's cool. I mean, I'm actually, you know, able to look back at that period of my life and think, wow, you know, it's funny how I reacted to certain things as they were happening. But, you know, because it is slightly overwhelming, you know, all of a sudden, you know, forget about just, you know, what am I going to do on the show this week, but just sort of just getting adjusting to how all of a sudden people act differently around you, how the world sort of really does change. So, you know, you're sort of, you know, dealing with a lot of that and learning how to adjust and still do your comedy show and all of that stuff. But it was very exciting. It continues to be exciting. You know, like if MTV hadn't picked up my show, I wouldn't be able to tour around the world doing stand up right now. I've done my web show, which has been, you know, it's been awesome. You know, there's been a lot of people all around who've just really stuck with me. You know, and that's what I love about doing stand up is I get to go to a different city every week and I get to see all these people that are the hardcore fans of my old stuff who've stuck with me and are there to support what I do. And we have a great night. And then I also get to do something that's very traditional as far as the, you know, stand-up comedy. It's pretty much the most traditional form of comedy I've done and appeal to a new group of people who maybe haven't even seen me before.
And you were sort of... I remember when you first kind of launched the Tom Green like web portal where, you know, it was like you're doing interviews in your house and, how many years has that been now?
5 years
ago. It's been 5 years. Yeah. Cause I
and
remember
I just,
you.
I just stopped. It's on hiatus. So I'm not doing any more shows from my house. The studio's gone.
Oh, you got rid of it.
Yeah. People don't really know that yet because there's so much, you know, there's thousands of these shows floating around YouTube and on my website on tomgreen.com and people can go watch them. And we've had so many great guests and I had so much support from the creative community here in LA and so there's all this information flying around there. The perception is I'm doing a show in my living room, but I actually just stopped doing it about 6 months ago and I will do more web-based programming again, but right now I'm not.
You're doing the stand-up too. Yep. I mean doing the stand-up, it, like especially if you're working up to a special, you really got to focus on that.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, you know, I'm on the road full time. I come home for a few days here and there every month. And when I'm there, I just kind of want to be able to sit in my living room on a couch.
Yeah?
Yeah. Not look at a bunch of cameras, you know?
When is the special coming out that you're shooting?
I'm not sure the exact air date. Probably be in the new year, though.
Okay.
February or something like that.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, the Wilbur is an amazing place.
Yeah, everybody listening, come to the Wilbur September
Theater.
30th. Tell everybody on your Facebook page, on your MySpace... To come to the...
You don't want anyone telling anyone anything
on your Friendster. Go on your Friendster account.
Jonah, you got to get one of them friend adders on MySpace.
I don't.
You got to get as many friends as possible.
I don't think.
Yeah, no, you got to get one of them automatic
I'm
friend adders.
I'm still trying to figure out Blingy.
Will you put me in your top eight?
Sure.
Can I be in your top eight?
Sure, yeah.
Oh, that was a thing.
That was man, why'd you take me out of your top eight?
Yeah.
When did you kind of start to were you always pretty digitally? Because I'm fascinated to talk to you about because you do talk about addiction to technology, but you also have stuff that heavily relies on the technology platform. So what's your sort of give and take? What's your healthy balance between those two?
Well, I canceled my Facebook. I'm not on Facebook.
You canceled it?
Yeah.
Wow.
I deactivated it. Uh-huh. You're not actually able to cancel it. I think you can now, but for a while you couldn't.
Yeah, they'll keep all
it.
Your information forever.
Yeah. So there's no Facebook page. There is a like page, which I don't run or operate, which is operated by a viewer of my web show. But I'm on Twitter at Tom Green Live. Mm-hmm. I love that. I love playing with the Twitter. I mess with the Twitter a lot. I'm, you know, as I'm traveling around, it's kind of fun to be able to roll into a new city or place and send out a tweet and see who's around and what happens. It's interesting. And I don't really sort of have the same sort of overall sort of issues with it as far as it's I don't just really don't think it's sort of as invasive as Facebook.
Right.
The way it connects everybody in the world and in your life and your past and your present and together. I think there's something wrong with that. So I've got off Facebook, but you know, I've always been really a huge technology geek. You know, I started TomGreen.com in 1996 when I was on Rogers Cable. I had a television show on the public access station, and I had a website on the internet. Tom Green, and you can go on a thing called WaybackMachine.org, which is an internet archive, and you can type in TomGreen.com, and you can see every version of the website over the last, you know, 15 years or so.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. I actually can't, I'm kind of curious to do
that. Yeah, you can sort of see all these different graphical layouts. And, you know, when we started, you couldn't do video, obviously. I remember a few years later, we started putting audio clips up, you know, as soon as you could do that. You know, in like the late 90s, I had, you know, 99, 2000 maybe, I did a thing where I had my cell phone set up so I could call and leave an answering machine message and it would post on my website automatically. So I was doing that all over the place, interviewing people and stuff. But, you know, it was a completely different world then. It was really appealing to hardcore technological geeks. Mm-hmm. It wasn't something that was mainstream. 99.9% of people, if you told them, hey, go to my website and listen to, you know, my audio interviews that I'm doing, they wouldn't have even really known how to
What's
do it.
What's that now? What are you talking about?
Yeah, exactly. So it was more coming from a passion for being sort of on the cusp of technology. I was in this rap group when I was a teenager, and I think a lot of that started because I just found out that, hey, you can make music and record it in your bedroom. And I went and bought, you know, a MIDI keyboard and an Atari computer and linked it all up together with a 4-track and started recording music. So I think that's probably why my web show started as early as it did, too. I was sort of amazed 5 years ago. I was, wow, we can stream live on the internet? I got to put 5 cameras in my living room, run them through a switcher, and start inviting comedians up here and doing, you know, living my dream of hosting, you know, a Tonight Show, a David Letterman show, you know?
But it definitely seems like throughout, like, it sounds like everything that you've done, there's a very kind of entrepreneurial sort of, oh, I'm just going to make the thing I want. I'll just make this thing that I want.
Yeah.
Like going back to even what you just said about I'll just record a rap album because I can.
Yeah. You know, I always got frustrated by the sort of roadblocks that get put in your path by these bureaucratic television networks and radio stations and things. Even when I was a kid, I'd go to the local radio station and try to get a radio show and, you know, you'd write up a whole proposal to them and they wouldn't put you on the air. Meanwhile, I was over at the college station doing like this really fun, silly show. And you were able to sort of sit back and go, wait a minute, there's a need for some loose, sort of raw, guerrilla radio TV. It's not there. And I've always sort of gone and tried to find ways to make it happen outside of the system, you know, because sometimes you can't, you know, you can't really do what you want to do within the system, to be honest with you. Even when you're, you know, completely successful and running a network, you know, you still ultimately have to sit, you know, you still ultimately have someone coming back to you saying, well, you can't really do that here, you know. And that's what's great about the internet. And that's what's great about stand-up. You know, you can say whatever you want to say, you know, you can frame it however you want to frame it. You don't have to, you know, editorialize it for reasons that have nothing to do with
it. I can imagine so many of those meetings. I can imagine so many of those meetings of you early on. People are like, Tom Green, we got to get Tom Green on our thing. Tom, we want you to be you. We want you to be edgy. And then you start doing stuff and they're like, Tom, you know, we have sponsors. You can't do that. Or this other guy wants to write a joke for you.
It's not even always about sponsors either. It's really, sometimes it's just about this bureaucracy that exists, right? You're working with a large group of people. And everybody's got their own ideas, and everybody wants to contribute. So you sort of, in order to really, you know, have a happy, comfortable crew of people making a show or a movie, you kind of have to make compromises so that everyone is able to work together and have fun and actually make the finished show. And that's not a bad thing. It's just a different thing. It's a completely different thing. You know, the upside is that you get, you know, a huge distribution network. You get promotion. You're appealing more to a mainstream, you know, crowd, and also people have good ideas, you know. So, but it's not necessarily, you don't necessarily always get your true creative rocks off of going, I just want to go up and say this, and I don't care what anyone else thinks. So
I think some people kind of need that structure, though, because in a lot of senses, the structure of telling you can't do certain things, I think, forces you to be more creative in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Some people, some sort of creative geniuses that I've seen go off and be allowed to do whatever they want, you're just kind of like, ooh, that needed a little bit of structure. Yeah. Maybe it's not such a bad thing.
That's what I love about stand-up is those rules that are being placed on you aren't coming from some executive who's sort of in his first job and he's really, you know, he can't screw the show up or he's not going to get promoted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not coming from one guy or a group of 10 people. It's coming from an audience. Mm-hmm. So it's coming from, and it's not an audience that's there for any reason other than to laugh. So,
right.
You know, they're not worried about their job. They're not worried about getting a raise. They're not worried about getting fired. They just want to have a good time. So if you use that as your way of guiding you, you know, it's definitely
it's almost a binary system.
Yeah.
It's a binary system of positives and negatives with an audience. If they're laughing, it's a positive. If they're not laughing, negative.
Yeah, exactly. So
why are Canadians so fucking funny? I love Canadian comedy. Love it.
Yeah.
And also I feel like there's a little bit of a bleed over with some of some of the border states in America. There's a certain mindset that comes from that region that's very dry, but also it's clear that you're intelligent and a lot of that. So like, what is
then
it?
How do you define Canadian comedy? Because obviously the biggest Canadian comedy is also some of the biggest American comedy. Like, you know, Jim Carrey, is that
like
Canadian comedy?
Like the Red Green Show.
Okay.
Or,
but is Mike Myers Canadian comedy? Or
yeah, I think so. Well, yeah. he is.
I mean,
a,
I think so too.
I think so too. Or Kids in the Hall,
yeah,
or
yeah.
You know.
SCTV.
Red Green is very Canadian as far as talking about Canadian subjects and things like that.
But I mean, there's a certain. The Canadian humor is very dry and very. I don't know. There's a certain. I don't know how to put my finger on it. I just know it when I see it.
Like, I think we grew up freezing our asses off and pissed off about it. We grew up overwhelmed by American media,
mm-hmm.
and are very much aware that we're not American.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're an outsider looking in to this whole other world. And you can kind of sometimes see things that other people don't necessarily see in American culture, you know, just because when you come to America, it's a surprise. Mm-hmm. Wow. People are really, really, really into sports down here. Wow.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, you know, look how crazy everyone's going over that high school football team. Wow, that's crazy. And you sort of, you see that, whereas everybody else screaming doesn't notice because that's been the way it's been going on forever.
Sure.
You know, and there's millions of little things like that. So when you're, you know, a comedian and you're analyzing the world around you, right, and then you come to a strange land, right, and all of a sudden are looking around, you sort of pick up on some things. And I think there's also coming from Canada, there's a bit of a national sort of insecurity in a way. It's like, hey, we're the little brother, you know, but we, you know, nobody knows who the capital of our country.
That's an excellent
nobody
analogy.
Nobody knows who we are. I want to jump up and act out. And then also you would say, you know, I don't know if you can tell that I've thought about this, but you can say that there's a different cultural background. I mean, we're much more conservative in a lot of ways. You know, we have a British sensibility, the Commonwealth sensibility. So, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of things happening there.
It is interesting, and I'm always fascinated by Canada's identity. Because, you know, you have French influence and British influence and American influence, and you know, and what does it really mean to be? What does it really mean to be Canadian to you? And is it shitty that some people are like, oh, it's like America? And I tell people when they go perform in Canada, like at Just for Laughs, I'm like, listen, if you've never performed in Canada, we do technically speak the same word language, but we don't necessarily speak exactly the same cultural language.
Yeah.
They're their own identity.
I think the thing that's really interesting about it is, you know, Americans don't necessarily have that perspective on the world of what it's like to not be American.
Exactly.
To not be the biggest superpower
in the
world.
Very narcissistic
as
a culture.
So you grow up being the biggest superpower in the world, and because your media is so big, and that's overwhelming, you don't get as many of those sort of outside influences from outside of the borders of America and outside of the borders of American media. So, you know, like I was just in Scotland, and you talk to a Scottish person, and they really make it clear to let you know, hey, we're not English.
Right.
You know, we're not English, okay? You go to Australia, and you meet some, or you meet someone from New Zealand, and you say, are you Australian? No, what are you talking about, mate? I'm not Australian, I'm from New Zealand. And they get offended by it.
Yeah.
It's sort of a similar thing here. The difference being, you know, that Canada and America are so close together. America is such a worldwide influence on pop culture and media and what we consider fun and music and all these things that sometimes it can be comical, I think, more than anything else. Like, it's funny when, you know, like nine out of 10 people I meet when they ask where I'm from and I say Ottawa, they look at me with this sort of look on their face like they don't even register that it's in Canada. They sort of have this look on their face where, oh, I'm not going to say anything because I don't know where the fuck that is.
Is that Nebraska?
Is that in the Midwest somewhere? I've never heard of a basketball team from there, so I don't know where that is. You know? But it's the capital of the second largest country in the world and the biggest trading partner with the U.S., and it's just a few hundred miles from the American border.
You can just go there. If you have a passport, you can just go there.
It's funny. But, I mean, if you went up to anybody in Ottawa, Canada, and asked them if they knew where St. Louis was, you know, they'd look at you like you were an idiot for asking them, you know, because we're sort of aware we're surrounded by American media. So.
We are so culture centric. I'm so wrapped up on ourselves and that we just don't spend any time getting to know.
I don't think it's anything anybody personally decides to do. I think it's because, you know, we're brainwashed. I live here in LA for 12 years. I love it here, you know, and most of my friends are American. I have a lot of Canadian friends too. And I'm not bagging on it in any way. I'm just saying it's sort of the nature of the beast where, you know, you've got 300 and something million people here. There's a huge economy based around the media, and they're going to just sort of do what appeals to people. And if that's, you know, watching Kim Kardashian buy a Louis Vuitton bag, if more people are going to watch that than something about Canada or...
It's so weird having a media economy. Yeah. It's so weird having a media economy because it's not a tangible thing. It's like, what do they export? Well, they export experiences that they've put on a tape.
Moving images.
I don't know exactly. Shit. I don't know. But, you know, when you're in Europe, it's just the landmass is like people, the cultures are much, it's much more diverse. So yeah. I feel like, you know, you're going to be more aware of, you know, Portugal or Spain or Italy or England, because everything's just kind of like that EU is just a little more tightly packed. But America is this giant fucking bubble that it's just easy to get wrapped up in ourselves.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And without even being able to control what you get wrapped up in, we're all being told what we're wrapped up in every day when we turn on the TV. It's not really up to you and I. It's, you know, I mean, look, we're people that are in the media. We analyze what's going on, but 99% of people don't. They turn on Real Housewives of Orange County is on. Blah, blah, blah. Oh, I want to get that bag.
And then
They go to work and everybody at their office is saying, well, I want to get that bag. So then all of a sudden getting some bag is the most important thing in the world, right?
Yeah.
Where it's really just everyone's kind of been brainwashed. Right.
Just a little bit. And I feel like we've infected some of the, like, all the westernization of other cultures. I'm like, that's part of the vampire bite that they get.
It's true. I mean, I grew up in Hawaii on Oahu, and Hawaii has a lot of resentment towards just becoming a state and the way it was done. It was done
probably really, very similar to what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's just very, very illegal, but we're still a state. Mm-hmm. And we're still very American. And there's just this weird, it's like we're Americans, but we don't like it. We don't like being Americans. And there's just a weird
really
thing.
I didn't realize that.
Well, I mean,
would you rather be Japanese? Because you almost were.
Almost were. No, but there's just like, it's just the way it went down is the part that upsets a lot of people. And then the way the Native Hawaiians were treated, even worse so than the Native Americans out here. They're just like, they don't even, there's no place in Hawaii where they say, here's your reservation, here's your plot of land for you to do what you want with. There's none of that.
Right, right.
And it was done literally at, like, I think gunpoint was like the way it was signed over.
Sure.
But And the thing is, it's like how much the resentment there is, but how much they just embrace it at the same time.
Yeah,
and there's no fighting it because you are an American.
I do, and I do love. I mean, I don't want it to sound like I don't. I make fun of America a lot because I do love it, and as a comedian, I feel like we have the perspective of touring so much of our country or Canada or the world that most people never get to see, you know, like we really see the nooks and crannies as touring comedians.
Yeah.
And America is a wonderful place. And one-on-one people are very sweet and very cool. You know, just as a whole, I feel like large groups of people make kind of puzzling decisions sometimes about what they like as a whole. But
any person that wants to go into power is a piece of shit. That's pretty much any guy who has the personality type that once, like, you know, I could lead thousands and millions of people. That guy's fucked up. That guy's a fucked up weirdo.
You think so?
Yeah, there's no, I don't think there's anyone pure of heart that ever thought they could lead an entire nation.
I bet they, well,
except
they,
for Barack Obama Barack from Hawaii. Obama
from Hawaii.
Yeah. I think everyone starts, here's what I think happens.
And Rick Perry.
Super president.
And I think I think what happens is when you're young, you kind of have this idealistic view of everything. Sort of like when you're a kid and your teacher's kind of a dick and you're like, you know what? I'm going to be a teacher someday and I'm going to be fucking cool. And everyone else. And then you start getting into the nuts and bolts of it and you're like, oh, I'm the teacher now. Other kids are kind of being dicks. Okay, calm down, you guys. Hey, I'm just trying to be, hey, sit the fuck down. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're in a system. I think it's a two-way system. You know, you may be a little predisposed to becoming a dick, but the system also kind of punches you in the tits enough that you start becoming a little bit of a dick.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're
all turning into assholes every day.
Turning into.
I feel like that happened for me a long time ago. Yeah. Are there parallels between what's a typical, are the Canadian news, or do you guys sensationalize like we do, or are you guys
not really,
above
no.
that?
Not really.
Oh, thank God.
Was it fact-based?
That's weird.
You know, there's just not the same sort of competitiveness for ratings in Canada. It's probably more fact based, you know, you know,
and less fear based.
Well, Canada has a national program for the arts and entertainment, right?
Sure. Well, I believe there's tons of that, and there's lots of public broadcasting in Canada too. So,
do you think that takes away from the competition?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think look, there's a ton of positive things about the American media too. I mean, you have that many people watching, you have that much competition. It's going to create a huge industry, and that's why you have lots of Canadians from Canadian television who move down here and are living here and working here.
And we all work,
myself included.
We all, yeah, exactly. We all work in the American media. Obviously, we're able to benefit from it in certain ways, which is really great. I really do love going to Canada, and I love the different. I mean, I have never been to Ottawa, and I've never been to Edmonton, but I've been to Montreal and Toronto and Vancouver a bunch, and some surrounding areas, and Victoria, and they each have their own really great identity.
That
I really appreciate individually about each one. But what are some other places that if I'm an American and I am I just want to go tour Canada? What are some good places people should visit?
Well, if you wanted to drive across the whole country, you could do it in about a month and actually enjoy yourself and stop and look at stuff. So that's kind of interesting because the changing landscape is what's really kind of neat. You know, it is, imagine if you were to drive across America, but there was 1/10 or, 1/20 as many, how many, I don't know, there's 30 million, 1/10 as many people. There's 30 million people roughly in Canada. So you have these massive ranges of mountains and massive prairies and things that you'll pass through where you'll sometimes go for days without seeing even a medium-sized city, you know? And so that's exciting, and you get to see it all, and you get to see all of our, the thing is, if someone said, well, I want to go to Canada, and they pick one of the four major cities, our major cities are probably the most Americanized thing.
Absolutely.
You go to Vancouver, it's kind of like Seattle. You go to Toronto, it's kind of like New York. Mm-hmm. You go to Montreal, it's kind of
a
European
French.
City,
yeah.
Kind of more of a European city,
yeah.
More like London or Paris or something. All cities are pretty much the same these days. I mean, this is something I kind of I've become more increasingly annoyed with the more I tour is every city's the same. Everywhere you go in America, Canada, Australia, you know, every city's got a Starbucks in every city. You get up in the morning. It's like, you know, I remember when I went to Sydney, Australia, I was so excited. I've never been to Australia. And I get up in the morning in my hotel and I go downstairs and I order my triple grande vanilla latte, the same thing that I order every fucking day in every other fucking city in the world. You know, and then I go, you know, you go eat your Burger King and your McDonald's, and it's so it sort of can be frustrating. So when I'd say to people if they went to Canada to get out off the beaten track, you know,
yeah,
because that's where you're going to see some real natural beauty and you're going to see things that are completely unique to Canada. The Rocky Mountains, go to Banff, go do some skiing or snowboarding out at Whistler or in that area, or go to the East Coast, Halifax or Newfoundland is really out of the sort of almost like Ireland up there.
I would love to. I really do want to tour across Canada. And, yeah. I mean, not stand up tour, but like tour as a tourist.
Yeah.
And because I feel like
like Canada's ambassador to your show today, because I you know, I'm talking a lot about Canada here, aren't
I? It is. Well, I'm fascinated.
I'm like Mr. Canada today.
But I'm asking because I'm sincerely curious.
Yeah.
Just as an American, because I feel like most Americans, you know, unfortunately, are like, it's Canada. It's just like America, and I've spent enough time there to go. Parts of it are, but it's really not. It's a different culture, and you know, like it's, and because I feel like Canada's our brother. We should kind of go up there and sort of experience what it's like, because yeah. It's so easy to go there. It's just it's yeah. a whole other country, and it's easy yeah, to just it's go right there. There. It's,
yeah, we'll yeah. let you guys in.
We can let us yeah. in because I feel like part of the, you know, the gift of the gift of localizing the planet with technology is that we can communicate with each other instantaneously at all times. And the downside, I think, is what you were saying about how every community is becoming the same
yeah.
because. It's like, oh, they've got that. We can have that, too. And then yeah. it's like you never have to leave. Then it's like you didn't leave.
Yeah. I talk about this type of thing when I do stand-up, you know, at some certain points in my show. This is sort of important to me, you know, that people are aware of the fact that we are overwhelmed by this media culture and not necessarily always, as protective of this. Of our world and our culture as we could be, you know, our traditions. And, you know, if, you know, you go to any small town in America now and, you know, the Walmart set up and all the main streets shut down. And so now every small town in America or every town in America is sort of you drive into the city and you drive through the corporate mall structure. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's yeah. your Bed Bath and Beyond, your Cheesecake Factory, your, you know, your IKEA, your Houston's restaurant, your TGI Fridays, your Banana Republic, they're all built the same way. It's a major corporation that comes in and basically builds a town beside every town so that the town goes dead. And, you know, I can't stand that kind of stuff.
But I think the onus is, I think the responsibility does fall a lot on the consumers as well, because they do. I mean, there is sort of a social Darwinism that happens. It's like, well,
yeah, it's like saying it's the responsibility of somebody who gets brainwashed, right? it's their fault that they went out and you know, and
yeah, maybe, but I think
people are brainwashed. You know, you turn on the TV and the Super Bowl's on, and you go, oh, I gotta drink Budweiser, and I gotta go to the Cheesecake Factory, and I gotta watch Keeping Up with the Kardashians, and people are walking around. They're You know, most people are spending their time trying to figure out how to make enough money to pay their bills so that they can feed their family.
Mm-hmm.
They're not sitting around analyzing what is actually happening while they're watching television. They're just watching it because it's glowing in the corner
right.
and it's sort of entertaining them. And then all of a sudden they have this urge to go take all this money that they made. Oh, I went and go spend it on a bunch of crap that they don't need.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, the rich just keep getting richer, right?
Yeah, I guess yeah. so. Listen, all I want to do is make $100 million from this show, and then I'm completely on board all of that media taking over stuff.
Yeah.
If we can just exploit it enough.
Oh, yeah.
For that we personally make $100 million, and then I kind of want it to, then yeah. I kind of want it to go away. That's not weird, right? That's
no,
okay.
That's normal.
I'm
the problem.
I'm from the South. I mean, like I grew up in Tennessee and
yeah.
I was born in Kentucky. And so, I mean, I've definitely,
And, you know, that part of the country has such a rich history. Some of it's a little dark, but or a lot dark, but just in terms of, like, the things that happen there. But still, it is kind of a bummer. There was a war, and then some of the Southerners had a weird idea about what happened. But you do see a lot of, like, oh, that's too bad. They knocked down that was, like, 150 years old, and now it's now it's a Chili's.
Yeah,
that's kind of a bummer. But you know, if no one is patronizing that thing, like where does the responsibility fall? I think maybe some of it falls on the consumers, like support local businesses if you can.
Yeah, that's what I think the best way to do it. It's like literally like act locally.
Yeah,
but think globally. Someone should put that on a 50 million bumper stickers.
But don't think globalization.
No. Well, there's a lot of caveats in your rule, Jonah.
I know.
You need to go back and work out your manifesto a little bit better.
Everything's not black and white, Chris.
You go back to your cabin and work out your manifesto. But this has all been completely fascinating to me because I do, as I said, I do love Canada. But you're here really to talk about your show, which people should go to on September 30th at the Wilbur Theater in Boston.
Absolutely.
Our tickets
are on sale.
We could
now.
Do like a giveaway. We could do a ticket
giveaway. Go to TomGreen.com. You can get a link to the Ticketmaster selling tickets, and we could do a giveaway. I think I don't know how to do that, but we can do that.
I think the thing we can do is
Do everybody
you have an email
go.
For us?
Yeah,
everybody go to TomGreen.com right now and click on the tour section and see where I'm going to be.
Even if you're driving,
Boston, September 30th.
Sarah at Marlia.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's what we're gonna do. You're gonna give away your assistant's email address.
Yep.
It's easy to start another email. Yeah.
You know. No, it's fine.
All right.
Talking to my people right now, my peeps.
No worries.
Okay,
I got people.
Entourage of one.
I got people.
So what we should have people do is if they can name 10 Canadian cities without going online. Then they can email those 10 Canadian cities.
How are they
going
to email them if they don't go online?
How do you prove?
I mean, to look up.
How do we prove that?
We go on the honor system.
Yeah, okay. That's cool.
We go on the honor system.
They have to be spelled correctly, too. Right.
They have to be spelled correctly.
Their chief major export.
And you don't. They don't have to be in order of population density.
Yeah.
they just have to be 10 Canadian cities that you, on your honor, didn't look up.
No townships.
No. Well, wait a minute. Are we talking about, do hamlets count?
Mm. What about a fiefdom?
A fiefdom?
How many tickets do you have to give away? Whatever. So let's give away 10 tickets or 10 pairs of tickets?
10 pairs.
Wow, this is almost like a radio show now.
There you go. Hey, 10 pairs of tickets.
Hang on a sec. We're gonna,
you got shit. Tommy Green.
It is a snarl out there on the five, you guys. A Beanie Baby truck turned over. All right, so if you go to Sarah, S-A-R-A-H, at Marlia Leslie, MarlialeSlie.com, Sarah at MarlialeSlie.com. I guess let's say, like the first 10 people that can name 10 Canadian cities without looking them up will get a pair of tickets to see Tom Green tape his special at the Wilbur.
Awesome.
Ooh. Which is going to, that have you played the Wilbur before?
Yeah, once before. I loved it. I'm looking forward to coming back. I love Boston. I love the people in Boston. Definitely love stand up and have a lot of great stand-ups from there, so I'm looking forward to going back.
Excellent. Well, Tom Green, thank you so much for coming on the show today. And
thank you.
Has been really awesome and really nice. I feel like, I feel like we met sort of in passing over the years.
Yeah.
And it's nice to actually just sit down and be able to have a chat with
you. Sit down and hang out and record it and put it on the internet for everyone to listen to.
And then never speak once the record button's off.
Yep. No, that's cool.
End of show. Enjoy your burrito.
Thanks, man.
Thanks, Tom.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies and brands to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity. a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.